May it please the Court, Brett Bendistis on behalf of the appellant Regina Shea. Appellant brings this appeal to reverse a motion to dismiss that was granted in favor of the appellees by the Newcastle County Superior Court on account of a statute of limitations defense. It is the appellant's argument that the lower court's ruling was made in error because it failed to consider the proper standard for a motion for judgment on the pleadings. We are further asking that the lower court's order be reversed to have more discovery on the issue to give a full factual basis of what actually occurred. As the appellant did with its opening with its briefs, we will also be supplementing our argument with a discussion on the time discovery rule, its progeny, and how it relates to the Mid-Atlantic decision. At this time, the appellant would request 2 minutes of rebuttal time and ask if the court would like a brief resuscitation of the facts.
I think we understand the facts. You can go right to your points of law.
Excellent. Thank you, Your Honor. Appellant's primary contention in this case is that the Superior Court's ruling failed to apply the correct motion for a motion for judgment on the pleadings. The most specific instance that which we have issue with is the Superior Court's finding that the appellant should have known or did know that her ex-husband remained on the deed after the 2004 refinance. Now, under the applicable standard, the appellant's pleadings must be considered as true. It is our position that the Superior Court's ruling does not contradicts the appellant's pleadings. Most importantly, the appellant has stated in its complaint and its response motion that the appellees represented to her that she would be the only person on the property after the refinance and that her ex-husband would be removed. That appears in the appendix A6, A8, and A12, in which it specifically states that the appellees represented that she would be the only owner of the property. We would further argue that the front page of the mortgage, which appears on A29, lists her as the sole owner. So therefore, objectively, you could see from the mortgage that she would be the only owner on the deed. We would further argue that on A65, as a part of the pleadings, our response motion to the defendant's motion to dismiss specifically states that the appellant asked the appellee to remove her ex-husband from the deed, and they failed to do so. Now, according to the applicable standard, all these instances must be considered as true, and we have every intention of proving them at trial after discovery is held. Now, the Superior Court's findings, which are found on A75 and A90, state that the defendant or the appellant should have had notice that her ex-husband remained on the deed. However, this point cannot be true if the appellees told her that it would be removed, that it was taken care of. Therefore, she reasonably believed that it was taken care of.
Maybe this does go to the facts, but was she told that his name would be removed from the deed at some point, or was she told that she could refinance without his name being removed from the deed?
She was told that he would be removed at the refinance by the collective appellees. That is our position in this case, that she was told that once the refinance occurred, he would be removed and everything would be taken care of. And that is our position on the matter. And again, that is what we'll be testifying at trial.
Yeah. Is that alleged in the complaint?
Yes, we believe that it is, Your Honor. Again, on A6, A8, and A12 states that they represented to her that she'd be the sole owner. We also would argue that the response motion.
But read me the exact language in the complaint.
Sure. It states that the appellees were negligent. Plaintiff avers that DelCallo and Werb was negligent and or committed malpractice and breached fiduciary duties to plaintiff in the following regard, by representing to plaintiff that the property was in her name only. And it is our position that, again, you know, at discovery this will be able to be shown. And we also, again, stated very clearly.
Isn't it equally clear that at the time of the refinancing, she knew that the property was not in her name only?
It is our position that prior to the refinance, she definitely knew that it was in a joint name of her and her husband. As a layperson, she approached the refinance and was told specifically by an attorney at the refinance that her husband would be removed at that time. So therefore, she had been told by the collective appellees that it was removed. So therefore, she reasonably believed that he was removed. And we would also argue that by signing a loan package, which it only states her name, it states her name on the note, it states her name on the mortgage, on the truth in lending, everything states only her name. So it is objectively reasonable to believe that after signing all the documents, after being told by an attorney that it's only in your name and you're the only one signing it, that you would believe that the deed would be taken care of.
Who's representing whom at that refinance?
I believe that Mr. Armstrong would be representing both the bank and the and the borrower pursuant to the Mid-Atlantic opinion, which states, that the attorney is the informer, is the protector of the inexperienced layperson. You know, it's the attorney's job to supervise deed transfers. The fourth paragraph, which I believe is on page 25 of the opinion, further states that it's the attorney's job to make sure that the borrower knows of legal issues that only the attorney can provide, and specifically states that it must certify title and also make sure that that all the clouts on title are removed.
Did she sign anything at the time of the refinancing that indicated that she understood that the attorney handling the refinancing was representing both her and the lender?
Your Honor, we actually have not received discovery on this matter. The only thing that we know that she signed is the loan package. I cannot state with any certainty whether or not she signed anything regarding that matter.
Is it clear that there was only one attorney present or one law firm present at the time of the refinancing?
Yes, it is clear that the only law firm that was present was Del Callo and Werb.
So if she were represented at all, it would have had to have been by them?
Yes, that is our position on this matter.
Now, the complaint itself attached the May 30, 2003 letter discussing the fact that Butcher was still on the deed, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's true.
So that put your client on notice of the negligence that you're complaining about, didn't it?
Well, I would disagree with that, Justice Risley. The letter at that point put her on notice that, one, and something she already knew, that her ex-husband would be on the deed. But it also put her on notice that he would sign it over at the refinance. Therefore, when she reached the refinance, discussed these issues with the attorney, and the attorney informed her that it was taken care of, I believe that the letter almost becomes moot at that point. The letter also is from a year and a half prior. You know, another issue we have with the Superior Court's opinion is that instead of considering actual conversations between the appellant and the appellees, what Regina Shea told the title company, what she told the attorney, instead you're focusing the entire argument, the entire facts of everything, based on this one letter written a year prior to it, by an adverse party. So we would argue that the letter in that case doesn't have the same binding effect as the other documents, as the appellant's pleadings, and therefore the Superior Court opinion put far too much weight on it. As it states in the, I believe it's page 90 of the appendix, that the or 88. The Superior Court said that this is the only fact it considered, that this was the only thing that they needed to prove that she knew at the end of the refinance.
So your position is the allegations in the complaint are subsequent in time to the letter, and that on a motion to dismiss, since you take the facts in the light most favorable to the non-moving party, that it was inappropriate to dismiss the complaint as a matter of law because it was a factual dispute.
Justice Allen, that is exactly what our argument is. There is a plethora of case law discussing the time of discovery case. Let me just pull the issue here. There's the Myers v. Danbro, which is a medical malpractice case, which stated that, you know, whether or not a party knows that there's a claim is a factual issue, and it's not uncommon for these issues to go in front of a jury. We would also say the Price Coleman versus Price Waterhouse Cooper case cited by the appellees as the standard. You know, in that case as well, there was an issue of what the appellant or what the plaintiff in that case had known after the alleged injury. Again, it stated this is a factual issue. It needs to go further and it needs to be developed and be ruled on by a jury.
Was there a separation agreement that outlined the responsibilities of the parties before, at the time of, and after a divorce? Was there a pending ancillary hearing after the divorce on division of marital property?
No, there was not, Your Honor.
What is this, just a personal agreement between the parties that this is how they're going to work things out?
Yes, it was a personal agreement between the parties. They believed they had it resolved as part of the divorce. And again, it's too late, inexperienced like people who wanted to resolve it outside of the divorce decree. Therefore, they believe that it was resolved at a part of the refinance, at least.
Well, either inexperienced lay people or people that wanted to avoid attorney's fees and are now paying a price for it, one or the other.
And I would agree with that, Your Honor. The issue would be resolving it at the time prior to. However, we would argue as well that it was a part of the appellee's job, at least prior to refinancing, that a deed was finished and filed. You know, it's not so much that we're arguing the failure to include the deed was the problem. The problem was refinancing the property, informing her that it was taken care of, and then not following up or making sure that it was taken care of at the time. You know, we believe that discovery in this case will shed a lot of light on what was known, what was understood between the two parties.
Well, color me old-fashioned, but the file seems to indicate that lenders will actually loan people money on a piece of property that used to be owned as tenants by the entireties, but now is, by operation of law, is owned by tenants in common, and they'll lend money to one party while the other party's name is still on the deed? They don't, is that, do they just believe there's enough security in one half the property to cover the loan, and they're not troubled by the fact they don't have the signatures of both parties either transferring interest by way of deed or signatures of both parties on the mortgage? How does this happen?
That's my question as well. I believe that the way it happened was that you had, like you stated, there are two people on the deed, and then there's one person later. There must have been some kind of conduct from the title company or from the attorneys stating that this deed was resolved. There's no way that, like I said, it's axiomatic that a bank would allow a deed to go through or a mortgage and a refinance with only one person on that property if they believe that that truly happened.
I hope this isn't too far off your point, but I'm trying to get clear in my mind whose responsibility it was to tell whom what under the circumstances. Is it possible that what the lender was doing is saying, I now know these two parties whose names are still on a deed, by virtue of the divorce, now own this land as tenants in common, that it's severable, that there's enough interest in one half the property to cover this loan. So in the event that Mrs. defaults, there will be a proceeding at which we can have a partition of that property. It will all be sold, and we'll get our money out of her half, and Mr. Butcher will get the money out of his half.
Well, we would argue that no, that is not the way it happened. And again, discovery, we believe, will shed a lot of light on this. The title commitment, which we believe will show, the discovery, unfortunately, was due, I believe, a week after the motion to dismiss was handed down, so we never received it. But we believe that the title commitment will show that the loan was supposed to be closed in the name of Regina Shea, and it was not. It is not our position. I mean, we can't say with any certainty.
But the Chief Justice's question is different.
Okay.
They could close it in her name alone,
mm-hmm.
and she could mortgage her undivided one-half mm-hmm. interest as tenant in common. But what you seem to suggest is that the bank was really loaning her the money on the assumption that she was going to be the sole owner of the property. And to the extent that never happened, perhaps the bank is also upset with the way the closing was conducted, in addition to Mrs. Shen.
I would agree with that. However, the bank at this point, I believe that the title insurance would cover it if she foreclosed on it, if the property was foreclosed on. However, at this point, the appellant's issue isn't also just that it happened, just that he's on the deed. You know, there's also a $15,000 IRS tax thing which is attached to the property.
No, I understand. But mm-hmm. the thrust of the court's question
mm-hmm.
is consistent with your argument that this was too confusing for any layperson to ascertain.
Yes.
And that she went in thinking she was going to refinance, walk out with the property in her name mm-hmm. and a mortgage to pay. And what happened was she walked out with a mortgage to pay. The property remained in both names. Liens were filed against the property based on the husband's conduct alone.
Mm-hmm.
And then she was thrown into another refinancing situation.
Do the pleadings indicate that she was ever told that she was at risk if his name did not come off the deed of liens, as did occur, appearing on her property?
The pleadings do not indicate that she was warned. The appellant will testify to that she herself was concerned about it regarding her ex-husband's status on the deed and was very adamant that he be removed at settlement. And again, this is where the time of discovery rule comes in, because she was told at that point that it was resolved, which is why she didn't follow up on it, which is another issue we have with the Superior Court complaint, which stated that...
But that brings us back to the procedural posture of this case.
Yeah.
The complaint alleges
mm-hmm.
that she was told it was taken care of.
Mm-hmm.
And it's your position that conversation supersedes the letter and that she had no reason to think otherwise until all of these disasters occurred.
Yes.
And that was the time of discovery, and therefore her complaint should go forward.
Yes, that is our position on the matter, is that the pleadings taken as true satisfy a basis for the time of discovery rule. We would also cite the case of Reed versus Thompson Homes of Centerville, which is including in the second appendix for the appellant, which it essentially states that regardless of the specificity of the facts stated or a basis for the absence of knowledge, that once a time of discovery rule is set forth, that it becomes a factual issue, and it's no longer it should no longer be resolved as a legal issue. And that is essentially what our argument is that this is a factual issue and that it should have proceeded as it stands. We would also just simply like to discuss the application of the time of discovery rule in this case. We believe that as the, you know, the progeny of the time of discovery rule applies, is that, you know, the pack and process case stood for the position that if you're hiring a party professionally to handle an issue and that they proceed and don't alert you of any issues, then you are reasonably, blamelessly ignorant of the complaint. We would argue that in connection with Mid-Atlantic, which states that, again, it is the attorney's role to inform the layperson of what's going on, that these cases work together to provide a time of discovery rule application to this and other refinance cases. I don't believe...
And that's another part of the record that's confusing at the pleading stage. As you know, this court requires that if a lawyer is recommended by a realtor or a lender, mm-hmm. they have a duty to write a letter to the borrower or buyer and say, although I've been recommended by the lender, you have an absolute right to pick anyone you want.
Mm-hmm.
Knowing that I represent the lender, do you still want me to represent you mm-hmm. also? And then the transaction would go forward. But at this stage, we don't know if any of that occurred at all.
No, we do not. Again, we requested that in discovery.
And that's precisely why I asked the question I did earlier about what was the lender thinking about taking security in one half a property owned as a tenant in common. It might well be, as Justice Holland's prescient question points out, that the lender didn't care whether there was ever going to be a deed or not. Mm-hmm. And the attorney at the settlement was representing the lender's interest. Why would they care if they thought they had adequate security in one half of a property owned by the borrower as a tenant in common?
Mm-hmm.
While that's entirely inconsistent with decades ago when I practiced law, the way one would handle it, apparently it's inferable that that's what happened here. Because ordinarily one would think before anyone could certify title or any company would issue a title certificate or title policy that they would want to know there was clear title to the property, and unless there's a specific exception mm-hmm. that says there's that risk. And is that pleaded? Any of those problems pleaded?
No, they are not pleaded. The appellant's opinion in this case was that it was just supposed to be in her name. Obviously, we can't speak on behalf of the lender in this case.
But she signed the financing documents knowing that it was not at that moment, and it was not when she left the table for mm-hmm. the day.
I'm sorry, can you repeat the question?
She didn't plead that when she left the settlement room, she thought her husband had signed over a deed.
I believe that we've pled that she believed that when she left that he had been removed as a part of the refinance. Whether it's as specific as signing a deed, we have pled that when she left, she was under the impression, due to the conduct of the appellees, what was said, what was done, that he had been removed from the deed.
But there are circumstances under which they would not have needed his name removed.
Definitely.
But she wanted it removed.
Mm-hmm.
So the issue is, she knew when she left the refinancing that as of that moment, his name had not been removed. She knew it had not been removed. What steps would she legally be obligated to follow after that to confirm that he had been removed?
We would argue that being told by the attorney and not being aware of the fact that she could encumber just the property as herself as a mortgage, that you know she was under enough objective circumstances that she believed that he had been removed. We will add just briefly, since the time is running out, that these are all issues which, if discovery proves the appellees are more than welcome to file a motion for summary judgment proving that the title commitment was just for half.
But going back to this complaint, it's my understanding from what you said earlier that you either referred to a document and incorporated it by reference or attached the document from the title company or the mortgage lender that said she was the owner of the property on the loan. And not that she was the owner of an undivided one-half interest in the property, but she was the owner of the property. Did I understand you correctly?
I believe I may have misspoken before, Justice Holland, if I may finish my point. Our point was just that the front page of the mortgage just lists Regina Shea Boucher, not as one-half owner, it just lists her name there. In accordance with course of dealing, it would be that the owner of the property would be the only person on the mortgage.
Right, but there's no reference on the mortgage to owning it as tenants in common.
No, there's
not. Owning an undivided one-half interest. It's simply she's the owner. She's mortgaging it.
Yes.
Okay.
I'm sorry you went through your rebuttal time, but thank you.
Okay. Sure.
Good afternoon. May it please the Court, James Harker, a attorney for appellees in this case. I will not recite facts except as they may be relevant to the cases that we will discuss, but all cases at a trial level are not worthy of going to discovery or to proceed to trial, and I suggest to the Court that this is one of them. There is a 3-year statute of limitations under 10 Delaware Code 8106. This suit was filed almost 4 years after the event or the alleged negligence occurred, I believe on June 16, 2004. I only know that date because it's my daughter's birthday. In any way, the appellant contends that the statute of limitation did not accrue as of that date because of the time of discovery rule. We have to look, I believe, even though I know Your Honors don't like to dwell on the facts of the case, you have to look at the pleading to determine if the pleading is sufficiently states a cause of action which is not barred by the statute of limitations. And I suggest that the plaintiff's, the appellant's own pleadings fail to adequately state that cause of action and show that the time of discovery rule is applicable. The Court obviously has to ask itself, what is pled in the complaint? Well, what is pled is that the appellants hired the defendants to perform a refinance. What is not pled is that the appellants hired the defendants to resolve her domestic relations issues or to prepare a deed to the property. The facts show that this matter began long before this refinance, when the appellant chose to represent herself in her divorce and her property division issues. She wanted the marital home. She pled that she knew that in order to get the marital home, that she was responsible to obtain a deed to the property. That's in paragraph 8 of the complaint. She pleaded in the complaint that she asked her husband to deliver a deed. As a result of that request, in paragraph 10 of the complaint, Mr. Hitchens wrote this letter saying, no deed, you refinance, you resolve these property division issues, I'll give you a deed. That's the state of the title when the appellant came to my clients to handle this refinance. She knew Mr. Boucher was on the deed. She knew he wouldn't sign a deed until the refinance was completed, and that as a result of that refinance, he would not automatically be removed from the deed. Why? She knew a deed was necessary. She actually had prepared one and sent it to her husband to sign, and of course he refused.
Well, isn't there an allegation that she believed that the husband or former husband would be removed by the time of the closing?
I have struggled with that allegation and come to the conclusion that one's belief is not a particularly relevant fact for this court to determine. For example, I may believe that God exists. My belief is a fact, but my belief doesn't mean God exists. The same is true here. Her belief that she was the sole owner means factually she believed that, but it doesn't establish that she was the sole owner.
But how do we deal with the standard that we have to look at the facts in the light most favorable to the non-moving party? That's asserted as her belief. If discovery would show and there was a good faith basis for that belief, then the case would keep moving forward. But how do we simply ignore an allegation in the complaint, which, if true, would create a factual dispute?
Your Honor, I believe that her belief, as stated in the complaint, has to be justified, or at least facts sufficient to justify that belief be pled in the complaint.
Was read to us that it was represented to her. That's also in the complaint.
There is an allegation in a paragraph that says, we believe the defendants were negligent, or the defendants were negligent because A, B, C, and D. It's not, there are no facts stated in there. It's just a statement, again, of this is why we believe you're negligent.
But if the complaint says, we believe it because that was the representation, let's just call it a hypothetical if you want. How do we get beyond the standard that says we have to take that in the light most favorable to the plaintiff?
Well, I'm not sure I can answer that specific question. I believe the facts, as I indicated, her belief is a fact, but it is not relevant to her ownership of the property. We can't just permit lawsuits to be filed and litigated and go to discovery and expense of litigation based upon someone's belief that someone did something or didn't do something. If we had a statement in the complaint, a simple statement that said we hired defendant to prepare a deed or to complete a property division, I would say, yes, Your Honor, you are correct. Her belief may have some factual support, but there is no factual support for that belief that justifies the continuation of this litigation.
What obligations, if any, did the defendants have at the time of the refinancing to tell her the consequences of obtaining a mortgage on a property that she held a one-half interest in as a tenant in common without obtaining a deed from her husband, whether she believed she was going to get it through osmosis or in the mail or UPS or whatever from her husband? Did the defendants conducting that financing, issuing the title insurance, lending her the money, whatever their role may have been, did they have any obligation to tell her the consequences of taking on that mortgage without a deed from her husband?
Chief Justice, I believe they did, and we have indicated in our brief, although it's not in the record, again, I'm trying to combine my comments to the record, that she was actually told that her husband was still on the deed, and her response was that she was going to get a deed after the refinance. Now, I realize that's not on the record, and that's why I'm trying to confine my comments to what is on the record. But to answer your Honor's question, I believe, yes, there would be some obligation there, perhaps, to disclose in dealing with the paper what this new mortgage lien constitutes, which is a lien on her interest in the property.
Do any of her allegations speak to what she was or was not told about the significance of the absence of her husband's signature on a deed conveying his interest in the property to her at the time of or at some point after refinancing?
I do not believe it. There's anything in the pleadings to that effect, Your Honor, other than the fact in paragraph 8, she states that that she was to take necessary steps to have Butcher removed from the deed. I mean, it's an acknowledgement that she was aware of the fact that this step needed to be taken, regardless of Mr. Hitchens' position in his letter that he wouldn't sign a deed until certain events happened. She knew that a deed needed to be prepared, needed to be signed, and conveying her that interest.
Now, you referred earlier that the defendants were hired simply to do a refinance, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
But the complaint alleges that their arrangement was more than that. I'm looking at paragraph 31. The essential terms of that contract were that Del Calo and Werb would provide professional legal services to and represent plaintiff in the refinance of the property while protecting plaintiff's best interests, which included keeping plaintiff reasonably informed of the status of the deed before and after the refinance, and completing plaintiff's goal of being the sole owner of the property. Now, that's more than, I mean, that involves making her the sole owner, right? Isn't that what's alleged?
That is what's stated in that paragraph, but again, is it a factual allegation in this particular complaint? And I would suggest to Your Honor that it's not. It's, again, her interpretation of what the attorney-client relationship was when she hired them to do a refinance.
Well, if we take that paragraph as true, which we must on a motion to dismiss, the arrangement included having your clients basically have the deed placed in her name only, or the property placed in her name only, right?
The paragraph 31 states as Your Honor has quoted it. My suggestion, however, is that it does not state that was to be accomplished at the refinance. As I think Chief Justice Steele mentioned, was there in his question, was there any circumstances involving the situation where the deed could have been done after the refinance? I think that was a question posed to my other counsel. I'm just suggesting that the whole complaint is so vague, and the key paragraphs in the beginning basically state, this is what the facts are, and I would suggest to Your Honor that the facts, as shown in paragraphs 8, 10, and 11, clearly show the issue that she was not aware, that she was aware that a deed had to be signed and would not be signed until after the complaint.
But does the record reflect the purpose of the refinancing? In the normal domestic relations situation, you would have a refinancing for one or two reasons. One would be to have the person who's going to own the property get a new loan to pay off all joint debts and then have only a loan in their name, or to buy out the equity of the other person, or both. In either event, the consideration for taking on all the debts or taking on the debts plus paying for the equity would be you get the property. So in this case, do we know why there was a refinancing?
No, not specifically, no, Your Honor, other than an allegation that, in paragraph 8, that she was to have Butcher removed from the mortgage. So to answer your question, I believe that was a stated goal, that he would be removed from the mortgage. I think that's confirmed by Mr. Hitching's letter saying, I want to be off this mortgage. You refinance, get me off this mortgage, I'll give you a deed. So to answer your question, I think Your Honor is correct. The purpose of this would have been to have Mr. Butcher's name off that mortgage.
Well, and that comes back to what's unknown about the lender. You would assume, as Chief Justice Steele and I recall from our private practice days, that the lender would have expected her to have the property in her name alone. So simultaneously with the closing, there would have been a deed from him to her. The property would have been in her name alone, and she would have mortgaged her interest in the entire property, and the prior mortgage would have been paid off. But what we see here is either a new practice or something that's pretty convoluted.
I don't think it's a new practice, Your Honor. I think that what you've stated still exists in our real estate practice. But what I, again, wish to emphasize is the fact that the root cause of this issue is she is blaming the defendants for failures to represent her in essence a domestic relations matter when she came to them as real estate lawyers. And in terms of application of the time of discovery rule, putting it as to whether she's blamelessly ignorant, first, I hardly believe that the state of title, whether you own or not own a piece of property, is not inherently unknowable. But putting that aside, the pleadings clearly show that she knew that those items or that title was owned by her husband, and that he agreed or stipulated in his letter that he would not remove it until she refinanced.
Is it correct that as late as October 4, 2007, she filed a petition in family court to partition the property for the purpose of getting her former husband off the deed?
That was alleged. I don't know that for a fact, but that was alleged in the complaint.
What's the significance of that, if any?
I don't believe there's any significance. The appropriate time to gauge whether negligence occurred was on the refinance date. The fact that Mr. Hitchens' client wouldn't sign a deed after the refinance, as he had promised in the letter, really has no particular bearing on the fact that this refinance occurred a year before then.
Does it have any bearing on whether it's inherently unknowable for her to fail to recognize that her husband is still on the deed and hasn't been removed when she files a partition petition to get him off the deed?
Well, obviously at the time she filed the petition, she must have known he was on the deed.
And that was before she filed this suit.
Before she filed this suit, yes, Your Honor.
This is so perplexing, this whole, I think the best word, Justice Holland, is convoluted. How does one file a petition to partition property after a divorce in family court if you haven't retained jurisdiction of some kind over the parties and their property after the divorce? What is going on here?
Your Honor, I would believe the Court of Chancery would have jurisdiction over a partition proceeding, not family court. But
well, family court's a court of equity as well if it involves marital property, but do they have jurisdiction after the divorce and no one's asked them to retain jurisdiction for a marital property division?
I would suspect not, Your Honor.
What a mess.
Well, let's look at this to see whether her beliefs were logical. Lay people sometimes think a mortgage has something to do with owing money, when in fact lawyers know the note says you owe the money, and the mortgage pledges the property as security for the debt evidenced by the note. So we have a situation here where Mrs. Shea goes to a lawyer and says, look, my husband and I, former husband and I, signed a note, and we secured it with a mortgage. Now, I've agreed to eliminate my husband's personal liability on the note by refinancing the property, executing a note in my name alone, and then giving a mortgage on the property that will be in my name alone. Can you help me with the refinancing? You would think that a layperson would assume that they could walk out of the refinancing with the property in their name alone, since the purpose of the refinancing was to pay off the mortgage that secured the joint obligation and substituted a single obligation. Doesn't that seem logical?
Yes. If those facts were pled in the complaint, I believe that's very logical. Those facts were not pled in the complaint. There's not one sentence that indicates that basically my husband, not one fact that says Mr. Del Callo and Werb or Mr. Armstrong, please prepare a deed for this property. There's nothing in the record to that effect. As Your Honor pointed out, there's that interpretation of what that contract was supposed to mean.
So there's a factual dispute then on the nature of the contract?
No, sir, I don't believe there is. I think that the facts of paragraphs 8, 10, and 11 clearly show that she knew her husband was on the deed. She did not ask did not allege specifically in the appropriate place in the complaint that she was hiring these people to prepare a deed and resolve the other domestic relations issues contained in the letter. We've been focusing on just the preparation of this deed, but if you read the letter, it says, we'll do a deed, we'll do all these other things. You give me the truck or in the furniture and I'll give you that. This is This is a domestic relations mess in which a real estate lawyer got caught up accidentally, and I would suggest the pleadings are inadequate under the circumstances to maintain this cause of action. The cases which are cited, I only have a minute left, basically I think add guidance to the court, but are factually very distinct. And in cases dealing with the inherent unknowability of a surgical instrument left in an abdomen, obviously, I think that the ownership of real property is not inherently knowable. I believe that the only way that Ms. Shea could recover for filing a late complaint would be to show that she was blamelessly ignorant of the fact that no deed was prepared. There's no allegation to that in the complaint, that no deed was prepared. There's an allegation of belief, which, as I indicated to you, perhaps crudely in my allegation regarding the existence of God, her belief is not a fact which this court can hang its hat and resolve this issue. Thank you. I appreciate your time. Unless you have other questions, I've completed myself.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.
Please rise.